everyone, and welcome to episode 63 of season 11 of Movie Room Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is fellow movie buff and also an actor, or maybe it works the other way around. Maybe he's an actor who is also a movie buff, Lee Colley. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thank you, Rob. Very nice to be invited. Thank you.
Yeah. Did I get the order right? Like, which do you think more, are you more of a movie buff or more of an actor?
It's a very good question. I think that determined by the people who probably have a better kind of determination on that. I would say let's go actor, movie buff, but they probably merge at times, I would say.
Okay, that's completely fair. You know, I like the title for myself of movie buff, but it's because I'm just not a very good actor. So, you know, I wouldn't be able to make a living as an actor. So it's better just to stay as a movie buff and not make a living as a podcaster. I get to talk about movies that I love or miniseries, as is the case with this one. So Lee, thank you very much for joining me. This is going to be great. I'm looking forward to our conversation over the next 3 days. We have some really interesting things, and you know, for all the listeners out there, we have a big surprise that we're going to talk about on Friday's episode. But you're going to have to just hang in there to try and figure out what that surprise is going to be.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. That sounds really interesting. Cool.
Exactly. Yes. So episode 63 begins with Winters seeing the young soldier right before he gets ready to shoot, and ends with Buck and Winters alone again. Because you're here, my assumption is you've seen Band of Brothers probably numerous times.
Yes.
And I assume that you liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most seminal pieces of television. I think the casting is absolutely spot on. I think Damian Lewis is just extraordinary, and I think it's fair to say probably one of the most standout performances in a miniseries, along with the collective, who are absolutely tremendous. And I think it's fair to say who's who of British acting pops up in different episodes as well. I think if you go through Tom Hardy, Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, just to mention a few. I mean, there are many, many others in there as well. Not to mention, obviously, the Easy Company actors, which had quite a few English actors as well. So, yeah, it's honestly, Meg Liberman, Gary Davey, and Debbie McWilliams combined did a brilliant, brilliant job.
Yeah, no question about that. And, you know, it's for me, one of the things that always surprises me is the fact that all these actors are here before anyone even really knew who they were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Stephen Graham, I think, pops up in one of the episodes, or maybe a couple of the episodes.
Also, Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg is in the first.
Yeah, Simon Pegg. In the first two episodes. That's right. Yeah.
There's a lot that just jump out that don't, you know, that you wouldn't have thought of beforehand, you know. I think it's safe to say that the only people that might have been recognized before are Donnie Wahlberg, maybe Damian Lewis, but probably not. Michael Kudlitz, again, maybe.
Yes. True. Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah, Donnie Wahlberg, definitely. Damian Lewis was in something over here called Hearts and Bones, I think, which was a BBC One drama, which I think that was the first thing that drew my attention to him. I wasn't really aware of him before that, and he was very, very good in. And I'm not sure. There was a BBC drama called Warriors, which I if you've not seen it, I ask you to seek it out. It's fantastic. It's like a peacekeeping mission that they have to do in Eastern Europe. And Damian Lewis, Matthew McFadyen, amongst others. Yeah, check that out. That's really, really good as well. And I can't remember if that came before Band of Brothers.
They both came before.
There you go.
Warriors, okay, Warriors was in 99, and Hearts and Bones, there were, I think, 8 episodes. between 2000 and 2001.
Yeah, there you go then. There you go. So I'd seen him in a couple of things beforehand before I saw Band of Brothers. Yeah.
Right, but that's what really, you know, that's what gave him the job even of Dreamcatcher. You know.
Yeah.
The great TV shows that he was in. You know, obviously the
Millions. Yeah. Homeland. And Homeland. So on, yeah.
The first season of Homeland, no question about that. But,
yeah.
You know, that's just amazing. But again, I still love him in Band of Brothers. I think that's his, in my opinion, his best role. Best role. Because you can really feel Dick Winters in the role that he plays.
Yeah, did I read once that Dick Winters walked off the set of Band of Brothers? Is that correct? There was something along those lines. I thought I read that.
Because he was crying.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it was. Sounds incredible.
I've actually heard that happened with a number of the Real Men.
Right, right.
Not just with Winters. You know, I'm assuming that you know, people who were on the set with them would be able to confirm that a little more. But
yes.
But I know that I mean, obviously it's a very emotional thing for all of them. I mean, we talked what was it, about a month and a half ago. We had the interview with Eric Flint, who talked about that he was you know, he was doing a tour and he was with Malarkey, and I believe he said it was Buck, and he said when they got to places where, you know, good friends of theirs lost their lives, they got very emotional there. Rightfully so. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not trying to knock that for a second or think that that's not true. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. It wouldn't surprise me if someone like Winters, you know, also would have gotten emotional while revisiting these tragic stories of his past.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if tragic is the right way to use it, but he's emotional. You know,
of course, yeah, very emotive. And it's the authenticity that was brought in Band of Brothers, I suspect, probably brought it like really viscerally to them as well. I can well imagine.
Right. Okay, and again, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, of course it does, yeah.
Let's start talking about this 5-minute segment. So, you know, we're back at the crossroads itself.
Yes.
And, you know, we have Winters once again thinking about what happened at the crossroads. Yeah. And he constantly keeps thinking about this young German soldier once again.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, this is a great way for them to show. I mean, this actually connects with what we were talking about with Winters, with the real Winters, you know, getting emotional about all this.
Yeah.
You know, that we see that even not long after these events took place, you know, the character of Winters, at least, he's in Paris and he's, you know, emotionally getting drained once again by something, by an action that he did. You know, and if I remember correctly, this is the last person that he shot, you know, in the war.
Yes.
I don't think he shoots anyone afterwards. So that also says something, you know, you'd think that the first person is the one that someone would have the most emotional about, but in the end, you know, it's the last one.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think in that episode, the way that it kind of frames it for him is like, we can clearly see here's someone that, despite being in atrocities of war, still taking someone's life has that incredible impact upon him. And he's obviously someone throughout the series is so brilliant at leading, and he has this incredible demeanor and calm sort of personality and the way that he can kind of just rouse the troops when needed, but also have a cool head in the sense of anything that comes up which is traumatic or something that's problematic. And there we see that real element of that kind of, I suppose, the vulnerability and the fragility of him, which I think is so beautifully done. And the way that they kind of flashback it as well, I think is really done in that well in that episode, to kind of give the audience that clear indication of here's someone that is obviously damaged by war like anybody else, but seemingly has almost like a public face and a private face, shows completely steely leadership qualities at times, but then at the other time it's that kind of what's going on internally, what's going on, what's that internal struggle. And as you said, if it's the last person that he shoots, then it's going to clearly had an effect on him, in the sense of I don't know what position he would have been in where he could make that decision cognitively to go, I'm not going to shoot that person, I'm going to avoid that at all costs. There was obviously, you would imagine that obviously informed his next decision if he was in a similar position, if he had a choice, of course, if he had a choice.
Right. Now, I think also part of the whole thing else is that, and this is something that they've alluded to numerous times throughout the course of the show, you know, about his religious convictions. You know, the fact that yes. he, you know, they kept saying he was, you know, is he a Mennonite or is he a Quaker, you know, and all those things. So I think that's one of the things they're also trying to evoke here with this, that, you know, we're seeing that, you know, he's in battle, he's dealing with what he needs to deal with, but there still is an emotional toll on him. And it could be that there's also woven in throughout the whole thing is his question about his own identity of, you know, who am I? You know, if I'm pretty sure that he is a Mennonite and he was a Mennonite and not a Quaker, but I think that, you know, the ideals that he was brought up with is that you don't kill, but here you're in a situation where, okay, this is what you need to do. And therefore, you know, you are allowed to in these type of circumstances and things like that. So you can see you know, the way that it affects him. You know, and we see that he's like woken up from his daydreaming by a young French kid, you know, on
the train, isn't it?
Yeah. It makes it seem as if he's reached the last stop and the kid's saying, okay, you got to get off, you know.
Yeah.
You forgot where you were, you know, that type of thing.
Yes. True.
And then we get a little bit of time of watching Winters, you know, just walking around Paris, again, taking in everything that he has done, you know. And I mean, we saw when he was leaving the train station that it looks like they're closing the gate, meaning that not only is it the last stop, this is the end. You know, you're at the,
yes.
You know, it's nighttime. We're closing the trains.
Yes.
And then he meets that kid outside again, and the kid, you know, salutes him as he just walks off.
Yes.
You know, to stroll around the town a little bit to try to figure out the, you know, what is he supposed to do with himself while he's in this, you know, while he's on leave. You know, I mean, it even brings back the idea that in the first episode or the first part of Band of Brothers, you know, when Sobel wants to give him a punishment and says, "Come on, Dick. Take the punishment like a man. You don't leave the base anyway." And here we finally see that he is on leave and he's by himself. You know, he's not like the other guys where he's going to take leave with a bunch of them and have like a lot of you know, have a night on the town or anything like that. You know, for him it's a somber.
Yeah, I guess that would be very difficult for him to do. I think to maintain the command and to maintain that kind of relationship with the company, I suppose. So yeah, he would have felt very isolated, I suspect.
Correct.
At that time.
But I think it's also his personality. I think it's a combination of both. You know, there's the military aspect of it, saying, okay, this is my, you know, I'm because of my rank, you know, I need to act a certain way. But on the other hand, you know, the only person he would possibly go out with is Nyx, and you know, he and Nyx are complete opposites when it comes to this. Nyx would want to go to a place and just get drunk to deal with his own emotional and psychological issues here.
Yeah.
But Winters isn't like that. Winters just has to mull it over by himself, I guess.
Yeah. True.
And then we see him get off what looks like he's walking up some steps, and we see, you know, a couple courting behind him. Like there's a guy in a uniform. It doesn't look like it's a U.S. uniform. Maybe it's a British uniform. I don't know. you know, talking to a woman, and like he just walks by them, and you know, men, other soldiers just pass him by also, and he doesn't take note of anyone. He's in his own world with this whole thought. And the amazing part of the cinematography and the directing here is it really puts us in his shoes, you know, because also the music, we can feel everything that Winters is going through. As he's walking around, and we get to see a church in the background. I'm curious if that's supposed to be Notre Dame. I'm not 100% sure, but it is very possible.
Yeah.
And then he keeps walking down the street and doesn't know what to do. And we see that he's across from an American Red Cross area, and you know he looks around once again, just confused as to, you know, where should I go at this point in time?
And you alluded to it. It's such brilliant direction, because obviously it's Tom Hanks that directed this episode, and obviously being an actor himself, I suspect when he came to kind of storyboard it and come up with what he was going to do in terms of shots, I suspect he was like, from an actor's point of view, what would the actor need in order to tell that story? So it feels a very kind of personal episode, and I wonder if Tom Hanks selected that episode to direct with that in mind, knowing what was going to be conveyed in it. It's as you say, it's so masterfully done.
Yeah, it really is. I love the way to it. And then, I mean, the next shot is even more amazing. You know, we see a hand come into water, and the camera is underwater, looking up at this, and we eventually find out that you know, he has drawn himself a bath.
Yeah.
And he just gets into the bath just to soothe him. And we can see the you know, the steam coming out of it. You know, he's finally, after all this time on the line, being given some time to himself just to relax.
Yeah.
And, you know, take a hot
cleanse himself.
Mm. That's right. And I think that's also part of it. I think I think you hit it on the nose by you saying cleanse himself. He's trying to cleanse himself from everything that he has done up until this point.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. I love the way that they do that. And then the shot changes and we see John Wayne. And you know, John Wayne and Broderick Crawford having a conversation. And John Wayne says, every time I look at you, the 8 or 9 of you. Because I'll be all right. And then we get to see the audience, and Luz says, look at me, I'm John Wayne. And then Wayne goes, the customs department set me up with these great Navy whites. And then Toy screams at him and goes, Luz, shut up, I'm trying to watch this. He goes, I've seen this movie 13 times, okay? He goes, I haven't, so shut up. He goes, watch the movie. Fine. I mean, as a movie fan, that is a pet peeve of mine when people are talking in the theater, or they turn on their phones and things like that. But,
There should be a code of conduct. There should be a code of conduct in the cinema. I think, you know, that in fact, we have a podcast here with Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode, which you may or may not be familiar with, but they have this thing called the code of conduct, which is a certain checklist that you must not do in the cinema. You mustn't eat noisy sweets. You mustn't do this. You mustn't do that. So it's kind of humorous, but it also has a lot of like, if you instilled that, the cinematic experience would be so far rewarded, I think. Definitely should be done.
Which I think is one of the reasons why most of us have our own home theaters nowadays, because it's less of an issue, you know.
True.
But
Although we all like being in the cinema and watching something in a collective moment and having that shared experience. I remember watching Saving Private Ryan, and that moment where they come off the boats, I remember that collective, just that silence of that absolute almost arbitrary nature of them just coming out and just being gunned down. And you just like, I'll never forget that. That's one of those moments in cinema, which obviously then lent itself to being Band of Brothers being made. But it's extraordinary, the power of cinema when it's done so beautifully, and everybody in the audience is going, we're on this journey together, let's enjoy it together, and you know, and have that kind of moment respectfully as it was. Yeah, I'll never forget that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's part of the thing. We all can remember, you know, throughout our lives, all of us movie fans, we can remember times that we've been in the theater and you know, we're wowed by something that will, it's the same type of experience that we'll never be able to re-experience, no matter how many times we rewatch the movie. Yeah, that's one of my, I don't know if regrets is the right word, but, you know, I'm envious of people when they watch movies for the first time and are amazed by them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was amazed 20, 30 years ago from that movie, but now someone else is being amazed by something, but I can't ever experience that again.
No.
You know, I can experience rewatching it and enjoying it again. No question about that. But when you know what's going to happen, it's a slightly different than when you don't know what's going to happen. You know.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, and I think as well, like going back to Band of Brothers, where it's shot, that kind of almost documentary feel of some of the war scenes. It's, I think it was one of, you'll probably correct me if I'm wrong, because you are very well versed in all film and TV, but
thank you for the compliment, Lee, but not all.
It's okay. I can recognize it. Yeah, I think the way that it's shot, that kind of almost documentary feel, handheld feel of some of the battle scenes being so visceral, I can't think there was anything that came before that. And there's been many things after it that have used that same sort of filming technique, but I'm pretty sure it's the first use of it, but I might be wrong.
From my understanding, in a TV show, this was the first time that it was used. You know, because they took some of the ideas from Saving Private Ryan, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
So Saving Private Ryan was the first movie that did it that way, which is why it's so amazing watching Saving Private Ryan. But you know, people nowadays, when they look at movies, they say, "Oh, that's been done hundreds of times." But yeah, it's been done 100 times ever since, not before.
Ever since. Yes, exactly. Definitely right. Yeah.
You know, that was the genesis of that type of thing.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which makes it timeless as well, I think. Makes it very timeless, that show.
Correct.
It doesn't look dated to me.
No.
Like you still watch it and go, this could have been made, you know, a year ago, a couple of years ago. Maybe some of the grading a little bit, but hardly anything. I mean, we're talking minimal, I think.
Yeah, but I'm glad they made this 25 years ago and they made that 28 years ago. 28 years ago, yeah. So
incredible, yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want them to have been made now.
No,
because
true,
then we
true.
Wouldn't have been able to experience them for 2.5 to 3 decades.
You know, that's a very good point. Well made.
and the truth is, I honestly do believe that if they were to make those, either the Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers now, it wouldn't be the same because of the climate in Hollywood. Let's just leave it at that. I don't talk politics here or anything like that. But
I get you. No.
I think the climate in Hollywood would have completely changed everything if they would have made it nowadays. I mean, you can even see the differences between Band of Brothers and The Pacific and Masters of the Air. That's already an indication of how things have changed over 20 years. You know, all three are amazing, but they're all very different. And certain things that they did in Band of Brothers and then certain things they did in The Pacific wouldn't translate as well to an audience nowadays.
No, I agree. And it would be shot differently. I think there seems to be more CGI in things.
I was about to say there would be a lot more CGI.
There would. You know it would. I'm not a huge fan anyway of CGI. I think it looks like what it is, which is like an advanced computer game to me. But yeah, glad.
I do like CGI when it's necessary. You know, I am old school that I prefer, you know, if they do real stunts as opposed to having to do CGI, but there obviously are things that CGI will enhance, you know, especially if you're doing something in space or, you know, you have a huge explosion that it's just not logical to do the real effect.
Yeah, exactly. It's knowing, as you say, it's knowing how to utilize it. Like Christopher Nolan marries it beautifully.
Correct.
And there were certain film directors to do. There were others that you just go, it just looks to me like, a PlayStation game or something. Correct. Unfortunately.
No, I agree. I definitely agree with that. So do you know what movie it is that the two of them are, or that these men are all watching?
No, go on. Okay. I remember them being in the room with the projector and it's on and I sat there watching it, but no, go on. Remind, oh, wait. No, I won't say it, because let's see if you say it, and I'll say it, that, and I'll be honest with you, if that was what I was thinking.
Okay, it's a John Wayne movie from 1940 called Seven Sinners.
No, then. Okay, cool. Told you, I'd be honest.
This is the second movie that we've seen. I mean, in the first part, it was also bookended by a different movie. So, you know, this isn't the first time that we see the guys sitting in a makeshift movie theater trying to you know, watch a movie from the 40s. You know, in the first part in Currie, so they were watching the movie Mr. Lucky from 1943. Yes. So you know, here they're showing them a movie that's a little bit older, slightly older.
Yes.
Yeah, 1940. Yes. But why not? You know, it still works.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Because they need to give Luz enough time to watch it 13 times.
Yeah. yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those heckles have to be informed, don't they? Certainly.
That's right. Luz has a lot of free time on his hands.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Next time I speak to his son, George Lewis Jr., I'm going to have to ask him if his father really did watch that movie 13 times, or did they just, you know, or was his father a movie buff? That's even a better question.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, that would be good.
I think I'm going to actually text him as we're talking.
Go for it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that would actually be really, really interesting to know if that is true.
Whether it's artistic license, yeah.
That's right.
Good point.
I mean, I know that he was a comedian. You know, he was one of the comedians of Easy Company, but, you know, they might have just given his character more.
Yes. Yeah. To kind of support that characteristic. Yeah, yeah. No, probably could have been that as well. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I don't know. That's an interesting question that... You know, who knows? Maybe by the time we finish recording, we'll have an answer.
That would be nice.
Yes, it would be very nice. We'll see if he's awake at this hour. He's probably not. But that's a separate issue. Hey, everyone. This is Rob from the future. Just letting you know that it took about a day or so, but I did get a response from George. And his response was, I wouldn't say that my dad was a movie buff. Although going to the movies was something that we did routinely as kids, and I'm sure it was for him as well when he was a kid. The two movies that he remembers seeing with his father were The Sound of Music at a drive-in with the family a very long time ago, which I assume was in the 60s, and Saving Private Ryan. So that is the answer that Lee and I were waiting for. Okay, so at this point, you know, Luz decides to keep his mouth shut. And then Malarkey shows up and he sits down next to Percanti and Muck. He goes, "Hey, Skip."
Yes.
And then we get Twiggy. Come on, mm-hmm. You know, once again, stop bothering me.
Yeah. He goes, yeah.
Where you been? I'm looking all over for you. He goes, "Well done. I was home in Tonawanda, but then Hitler started this whole thing. So now I'm here. And you ain't got any craps." He goes, "Not so bad. Here's the $60 I borrowed." So, you know, it's nice that he is able to, you know, these. What I think what they're trying to show us here is how these guys are really spending this downtime.
Yeah, exactly. And that camaraderie, that friendship, that sort of.
You're watching movies 13 times and you're playing craps. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It shows their kind of their closeness, their sort of their relationships. Is obviously they spend so much time with each other. So they, you know, they got shorthand with their kind of, you know, ribbing of one another, or their bantering, if that's the phrase to use, I don't know. But yeah, I think, yeah, and I think it's, again, that's beautifully captured in Band of Brothers. Band of Brothers, the name says it all, but the fact that kind of brother-like relationship between Easy Company and how they sort of go through so many different emotional turmoil moments, and But the levity that comes in that this series, I think, is really nice. It just kind of lifts it. You just go, oh, you can see how three-dimensional they are. You can see the, you know, and I think, I mean, I'm referencing a different show now, but Generation Kill, I remember watching that.
Okay.
HBO mm-hmm. series.
Yeah.
And the evidence of that was that they had so much time of which nothing happened, of which nothing at all happened, and how they filled the space and how their different kind of personalities, because obviously they were in a very sort of claustrophobic setting. It was a really extreme hot temperature climate, and they have this Rolling Stone journalist with them kind of documenting what they're doing. And yeah, just to kind of understand how they dealt with the downtime, for want of a better word. And I think at Band of Brothers, they show those little moments all the time, those little vignettes of them, kind of what their relationships are beyond obviously being extremely competent soldiers and working as a collective. So yeah, no, I think little moments like in this episode, and I'm trying to think which other episode, where there's something quite, there's, I think, is it right in thinking at the start of this episode, there's a bit of like, from Nixon at the beginning with Winters, is that right?
Yeah.
So there, I think those little moments are really important, because they just kind of, they rubber stamp this kind of, you know, closeness that they had, really, I think.
Correct. No, I completely agree with you. So he mentioned $60, 60 bucks. How much do you think yes. 60 bucks in 1944 is worth today?
Today?
So just to give us a type of idea that how much money he borrowed from Muck.
Well, I guess we're talking a couple of hundred, right? Something like that.
$1,100.
Wow. Is it really that much?
Yeah. I mean, and that's just amazing. You know, it could say in numerous things, but what I think it says is that, you know, these guys know that you know, any moment their lives can be gone. So, you know,
yeah,
what's 60 bucks to lend to somebody? You know, here's, I'm going to give you $1,000. That's just like, wow.
Wow. You know,
which on the one hand, it shows their closeness. On the other hand, shows that okay, we're living on the edge. If you need to borrow that 60 bucks, I don't need it right now. So, you know, and pay me back whatever you want. You know, which, you know, as we continue with the conversation between them, you know, so Muck then says, you're paying me back? Like, he wasn't even expecting to get paid back.
If
I lend someone $1,000, I think I would be expecting them to pay me back. That's what I would think.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I could be wrong, but you never know.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's incredible to think it was that kind of money, isn't it?
Right. And then he goes, wow. And as a thank you, and then he goes, surprising. He goes, a tip. And he gives him more money. Again, we don't know the exact amount he gives him. Doesn't really matter. He goes, Jesus.
No.
And then he screams it out really loud. And then Toy and Lip both turn around and go, shut up.
Yeah.
And then Malarkey goes, I was up $6,000, but I only have 3,600 left. You know, so again, thinking of those numbers also, mm-hmm. you know, think about that. He made over $100,000. You know, and it
was, that's incredible.
And then lost half of it and doesn't care.
No.
He still has $66,000 with him. You know, so I was like, wow. And then Bracante goes, what are you going to do with that, all that dough? He goes, blow most of it in Paris as soon as possible. Bracante goes, give me a tip.
Yeah. That's great.
And then we're back on the screen, and John Wayne talks again and goes, I don't think that climate in here agrees with you. As a matter of fact, I've been worried about your health altogether. And then we see that Winter shows up in the theater and walks over to Buck, who, just to remind everyone, in the previous part of this series, Buck got shot in the ass. And, you know, they said it made 4 wounds because it went through each cheek, clean through, which is, I guess, one of those million-dollar wounds, I guess they say. And Winter shows up and goes, hey, Buck. He goes, you don't, and then we hear John Wayne say, you don't look well, which is also clever the way that they add that in there. From the movie at the same time. And then Winters continues and goes, how are you feeling? Your wounds all heal? All 4 of them? He goes, you've seen this before? And Buck is just staring out in the space. And then he goes, fuck. He screams at him, "Is it any good?" And Puck then snaps out of it and goes, "Yep, it's a real corker." So then, you know, it's just they're laying the groundwork for what's going to happen to Buck later on. So
yes,
you know, it's a nice way to put it in here, except for the fact that it really shows us that even before they get to Bestone, he's already you know, starting to have these issues, even though from what Eric told me, it's not 100% true. You know, he wasn't as shocked as they portray him to be.
Right. You know. That happens a lot in war movies, don't they? They take some
liberties.
liberties, yeah. I was going to say artistic license, but we'll go with liberties. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I was watching the Enigma Code movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, and like when I don't know if you've seen that, but during the Second World War, when basically they're in the pub, and basically he hears what this person says, "Oh, they're signing off. The Germans are signing off their messages like this," and it's like a eureka moment, as it were. But I latterly found out that isn't obviously what happened. What happened was when they went back to their kind of control room, it took several more kind of attempts, and basically there was also they'd managed to steal an Enigma machine from somewhere. So actually, some of the coding actually came from that, as well as what Alan Turing was doing, basically. So what you see in the film is not that. What you see is that eureka moment. They run into the office. He's kind of like shuffling around papers. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, that's it." Because they keep saying Heil Hitler, or they keep saying something which is like repetitive that they can kind of crack as their code, as it were. And you get, but as an audience, you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't know that unless you went and did the further study afterwards. So yeah, I understand why.
Essentially, you're saying that it's the same scenario as with Marvin in Die Hard 2, you know, where he happens to find the walkie-talkie with the code already punched in.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many examples of it, aren't there? I think it's just because I watched that one recently. I was just like, I'm fascinated by different movies that have been made and what how true they are to,
correct,
you know, exactly what happened and how much has been sort of, let's say, elaborated, correct, for, yeah, artistic purposes.
I mean,
which is fine.
This is the first of my 12 movies that is really based on a real story, because, you know, The Great Escape is, they take lots of liberties. Yeah, it's very fun, but you know, this is the one, I guess, is the closest to what really happened, I guess you can say. So I can understand that. I can understand that. And then we're back with Luz, and he whispers to Lip. He goes, "Lip, favorite part." And then on the screen we hear, Luz goes, "Got a penny? Got a penny? Got a penny?" And then Marlene Dietrich says, "Got a penny?" And John Wayne goes, "Sure." and then one of the guys goes, "What?" And then someone comes in, they turn on the lights, and they go, "Quiet. Come on, quiet. I said quiet. Elements of the 1st and 6th SS Panzer Divisions have broken through into the Ardennes Forest. They've overrun the 20th Infantry and elements of the 4th. All officers report to their respective HQs. All passes are canceled." And then everyone groans together and goes, "No." He goes, "Listen,
yeah.
Report to barracks and your platoon leaders." And then the guys just get up and start walking out. And, you know, they file out one by one. And then, you know, Malarkey goes, "Damn, what a day. Unbelievable." And then he turns to the toy and goes, "Got a light?" And he goes, "All right, there you go." And he gives him the light. And we see that Buck and Winters are still there. And Buck is still sitting in his chair. Once again, going back to what we were talking about before, how it is keeping Buck in a state where when things happen later on, you know, it won't be as much of a surprise, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Yeah.
And that's how this 5-minute segment ends. So, Lee, did you have anything else you wanted to add about this segment?
No, I just think I like the way it juxtaposes that moment of kind of like their time of, you know, who they are as humans and their sort of I guess you kind of like that when they have that time collectively watching a movie or whatever it is, and even if you've got someone like chipping in with a bit of, you know, heckling here and there, it all goes to show their sort of comfortability, I suppose, around each other, for want of a better word. And I think it and then obviously then they get called, right, you know, passes will stop for everyone, we gotta go, this is it. And when he comes parading in to do that announcement, there's that sense of foreboding, I think, you know, in okay, we've had that moment of just being okay, we're relaxing, we're all kind of having a bit of fun and chatting, yeah, sorted out what I owe you, and then bang, realization, okay, we've got to go to work, this is where we're going to go now, and who knows where that's going to take us. And I think that happens a lot in this series, I think, whether you have moments of, more than anything else, I think that again why it stands up is that all of the characters are so rounded that you really do invest in them as human beings, as well as obviously the functionality of what a nuts and bolts war series or film does, mm-hmm. which obviously has that incredible battle scenes, and obviously you understand about the political nature. But yeah, to just yeah, that on this, I mean, you know it better than I. I mean, I sat and listened to your podcast, and you forensically go through like every, and I've seen Band of Brothers countless times, but I'm educated by you and your guests' endeavors as you go through them. I'm like, wow, maybe that passed me by. I didn't even notice that moment or whatever it might be. So I went back and went, oh, okay, to have a look. So yeah, then. Yeah, that would be my conclusion. Really.
Well, that's the point of doing these things, movies, you know, minute by minute, or 5 minutes by 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so you can get in depth. You know, I truly would have loved to have done this the true minute by minute fashion, but I didn't want to spend 2.5 years doing it. So that's why I took the shortcut of just doing it 5 minutes at a time. You know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
All right, so today's segment is Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. So, Lee, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, so my fifth one is Brian Slade from Velvet Goldmine. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, so he would be my first, because I remember watching that movie and sort of going, I think it's an underrated movie, actually. I think it's a movie that perhaps got lost in, maybe people didn't kind of recognize it, in the sense it just felt maybe a little light, but actually I think there's some really nice moments in it. And some great work from Jonathan Rhys-Meyers in that movie. And I would say to people, if you've not seen it, check it out. You'll quite enjoy it, I think.
Cool. Okay, your number four?
That would be the Dan Band from The Hangover. But also, I latterly found out it was in Old School as well. So, yeah, that's another band. I was trying to remember films that I'd seen where I remember bands thinking, oh, are they real? And I'm going to caveat this, because this may mean something to your listeners, but I'm going to say it anyway. So there used to be an Australian soap, or it might even still exist, called Home and Away, that was on all the time in England. Yeah. And quite often, the children would go and see a band called Frente, which I always believed to be a fake band, because you never ever saw them seeing Frente. They're just going, we're going to Yabby Creek to go and watch Frente. And I always thought that Yabby Creek was this tiny little kind of like village, as opposed to like a town or a place where you would have like a venue. But no, apparently this band, it really exists. They've got quite a following. So there you go. You don't always know that these bands are completely fabricated.
Right. That's why you have to do the research.
Exactly. Yeah, indeed. You want my third?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So that would have to be Robbie Hart from The Wedding Singer, which is probably one of the funniest moments, when he sings to Drew Barrymore, when he does that kind of seemingly beautiful heartbreaking ballad, and he just breaks up into that kind of thrash metal absolute emotional turmoil that he goes through. So yeah, that always lives long. That's a very funny movie.
All right, your number two.
So now I'm actually going to switch this because I'm quite proud of this one. So my number two is Wild Stallions, Bill and Ted. I remember, so I didn't see the first movie initially. I actually went to see Bogus Journey with my friend at school, and I was just so enraptured by it. I was like, I need to see more. And I watched the first one, obviously, which is superior. But I can just, you know, see Keanu and Alex Winters playing that. I've got a little story. I was in a club many, many years ago, and basically the nature of it was I was very fortunate to be taken to a particular area, and I sat with Alex Winters and I was having a chat with him, and I was saying to him about The Lost Boys, which I loved, and obviously talking about Bill and Ted. He was a very, very amenable, really charismatic, just lovely, friendly, welcoming chap. So yeah, a big nod to him if he's listening.
Well, I hope he is. That would be very nice.
Yeah. Okay, and the top of the tree is the Fabulous Baker Boys, which is a brilliant movie with Jeff Bridges and Bo Bridges. And just always remember that movie with Michelle Pfeiffer, just this kind of siblings that are these kind of like, not lounge singers as such, but yeah, again, if you're not seeing that movie, check that out. It's really good.
Excellent. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that. Okay, so every day we also have a daily trivia game called Name That World War II Movie. So I'm going to give you a little bit of hints,
right,
and you have to try and guess what movie we're talking about. So let's spin the wheel.
Okay, let's get back.
That's right. Let's spin the wheel and see what we get.
Okay.
Hopefully it'll be something that you've seen.
Let's hope so.
Okay, so this is a movie that came out in 1979, starring Richard Gere and Lisa Eichhorn, along with Vanessa Redgrave, and it takes place in England, and it's about some American soldiers spending time in England before the invasion.
Wow, I don't think I've ever seen that. I was trying to think. I was thinking of all the Richard Gere movies I know. No, I can't even pretend. No, go on. What's
it
that?
It was directed by John Schlesinger, and it's called Yanks.
Oh, right. I've never seen it, but I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
I saw it a few years ago. It's actually not that great. It's an interesting It's an interesting movie, but I wouldn't classify it as being something that's enjoyable.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. So, Lee, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you if they're interested in getting in touch with you?
Okay. Well, they can find me on Twitter. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I'm really not a social media person. I went on Twitter. I did a TV drama, and the writer sort of said to me, oh, you need to get on Twitter. It's, you know, you need to promote this, blah, blah, blah. So that is what I did a few years back, and I think the sum total of my interaction is I'm a massive football fan, and I've had a couple of interactions with some football journalists about my beloved Manchester United. So by all means, you can add to my minimal amount of followers. I generally will tell you now, I'm very rarely on it. So yeah, by all means, go for it. If not, if you want to actually see me do a bit of acting, if you IMDb me, you'll probably find something to see my face. How's that?
Excellent. Very good. Okay, finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So until tomorrow,
hooray!
Hooray!